Good afternoon. My name is Nancy Spanos, and I will be your host for the 500th edition of The LaRouche Show today, October 6th, 2012. And we will definitely make it a memorable show for this occasion. We're going to be addressing the question of the food crisis, which is here. And I will be introducing our guests in a moment, but first let me just give you an overview of where we stand in the calendar. That's a calendar not just for the election, but also the calendar for impending world events. Last evening, October 5th, Lyndon LaRouche initiated a series of webcasts which will occur at 8 p.m. on LaRouchePAC.com over the next several weeks, going through the beginning of November, to define the issues that should be involving every citizen of the United States and internationally in this immediate period, and what must be done to solve the crises we face. It was entitled The Moment of Our Greatest Crisis, and he led right off with what has to be done: Glass-Steagall, shift to a credit system, and NOAPA, all of which are elements that may very well figure in our discussion today of the real problems that we face. And so the two problems that he identified were monetarism and the British Empire, which at this point, with its control over President Obama, is leading us to a potential nuclear war. This is what has to be, but what we really have to do, the big problem, and that's one thing we're constantly addressing on this show, is the ignorance of the American population. Not only ignorance in terms of information, but ignorance in terms of a moral outlook toward what to do about that information. So that's what we're going to deal with today in The Food Crisis Is Here. Now, I have here in the studio with me our agriculture editor from EIR and one of your usual hosts, Marcia Mary Baker.
Hi, thanks. I'm here again.
Yes. She's shifting the side of the table to be the guest as opposed to the hostess. And then we have a couple regulars who are very informed and active gentlemen from the Mississippi Basin, both involved in farming and a long time in the Schiller Institute and the LaRouche Political Action Committee. From Louisiana, or Louisiana, I don't quite know how to say it, Fred Unifeld. He's on the Schiller Institute board, a founding member of Food for Peace. He's put everyone to shame in terms of his organizing for restoring Glass-Steagall, and has for 50 years was a leader in the soil districts movement.
Soil conservation.
Okay.
I think it's really in my DNA, but I'll tell you that story later.
Okay. Well, welcome, Fred. We're glad to have you here.
Delighted to be here.
And then in up north, although in the southern part of Minnesota, we have Andy Olson, a longtime farmer, LPAC activist, and founding member as well of the Schiller Institute's Food for Peace. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi. So I think we want to get right into this with Marcia leading off on what we face. Of course, LaRouche did address this last night. One of the consequences of the threat of monetarism, which has taken over our planet and the governing bodies of this United States, is the fact that it is destroying the physical basis for life on our planet. And of course, when you're talking about that, you're talking about food, and you're talking about an unprecedented crisis occurring in the immediate period ahead. So, Marcia, why don't you just lead off here?
Okay, why don't I give a summary picture from a world point of view, because of the absolute shortages we have, because now it's, after all, the harvest time for most of the world, because it's because we're talking about the Northern Hemisphere, and the wheat's been pretty much gathered in. And you see in the wheat belt of Eurasia that they have a terrific shortage due to the heat wave and the drought this summer in Russia, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine. Here in North America, I hope everyone is familiar, otherwise you'd be living under a rock, with the fact of the drought's impact in our farm belts, our corn, soybeans, and also hay, pastures. Andy may want to say more about that, or Fred too, in a minute. But, you know, we also have, because of the drought and the heat wave, big losses compared to last year or previous years in our corn harvest size, in soybeans, and quantifying it, let's not worry about the numbers. The Agriculture Department has gone into unreliability, about as reliable as the Bureau of Labor Statistics about jobs, which we've seen. That's a related thing. But about October 11th, this coming week, will be a monthly world agriculture supply and demand estimates for crops around the world. And the Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome a couple days ago did put out their quarterly report, and they had to say, on a world basis, if you add up this year, 2012, the different kinds of grains, I mean, there's other things that count, roots and stuff, potatoes, cassava, and so forth, but if you add it up, it's going down. It's going down from last year. And remember, this comes upon decades of underproduction. So it isn't like one bad year and surely everything will right itself. So that's why I mentioned absolute shortages, and the impact of this has a big effect. Well, one thing, if you look at corn, apart from our favorite tortillas and Cheerios and cornmeal and polenta, whatever you want, corn muffins, a great deal of U.S. corn would go to livestock feed here and elsewhere around the world. In fact, the U.S. in recent decades has become the center for a third of all the planet's production of corn. So when we say we lose some in the crop this year, we're losing, the world is losing it, not just U.S. domestic supply. So the meat sector, livestock sector, is really hit, cattle, hogs, chickens, all the poultry. And what this means for something like dairy cows, because milk's a very perishable product. It can take decades to really get your herd the way you want it, and they have to eat every day and be milked every day. And this situation where the dairymen in the country are getting less per 100 pounds than it costs them to produce it. So in California, for example, there's going to be a big rally in Sacramento, in the state capital, October 18. They had a pre-rally in September of a few hundred people. Because we're at the end of the line, as they say, the leaders out there of the dairy sector, and by the way, California produces more milk than, that's the leading dairy state in the whole country. They may lose 20 to 30% of their herds and operations in the next 90 days if something isn't done. So that's the general overview, that it's a crisis, it's absolute, and it's going from bad to worse.
And this will make 2008 look like a picnic, right? I mean, in terms of price, in terms of shortages internationally, that's why the FAO is so concerned about other things.
The Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, they have a market basket on a world basis. That's a little odd, but 55 products in it. And they said this week on Thursday that from August to September, dairy products increased in price by 7%. Pork products increased by 6% from 1 month to 1 month.
Right.
And it's going from bad to worse. So that's the general picture. Andy, you may know more specifics. One thing that the city folks, we're back here near Washington, that made the headlines is ranchers are casting about to try and keep their herds, and the food salvage brokers are going wild. They're finding old, you know, big old warehouses full of spoiled or broken food or, you know, lousy taco shells and mixing it in with the cattle feed. But this is no way of life, is it?
No, this is, I think this is the biggest crisis is the analysts or the people that look at this from a big picture, they say that in 2013, we'll have to cut 1.6 billion bushels of corn from usage as opposed to last year.
Wow.
So that poses the question, where do we cut? And this
is this global? This is global?
No, this is the United States.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And they're just the supply isn't there. Even though we had 90 some million acres of corn grown this year, because of the drought and the reduced production, we don't have the corn that they were anticipating. And so to make everybody happy, which to me is not the way to depose it, they have to cut 1.6 billion bushels of corn from ethanol or animal agriculture, or who knows where it's to be cut from. But there has been only one ethanol plant in Minnesota that's closed, and interestingly, it's Cargill's ethanol plant. And Cargill, they walk a different beat than most of the food processors. They're private. No one knows what they're up to. But they must have felt like that this was not a proposition to continue, or maybe they want to start the stampede out of ethanol. I don't know. An interesting sideline is how they're moving the grain from the surplus areas to the deficient areas. Castleton, North Dakota has an ethanol plant, and the byproduct is distiller dried grain, DDGs. And out of that bushel that's ground and then goes through the fermentation and so forth, about 20% of it is left, and that becomes this distiller's grain. And Castleton, North Dakota was railing this in unit trains down to Mexico.
Wow.
I mean, the transportation costs are exorbitant, but why it has to go to Mexico, I don't know. Hmm. But that's the law. That's the free trade, the law of supply and demand.
So we don't know what it's being used for.
For a cattle feed.
For a cattle feed.
And even then, Mexico, because of the drought area, continuous with Texas, Arizona, you know, the south, the continental drought, they liquidated their herds, that slaughtered them or sent them at a loss to Texas. In other words, exported thousands of their cattle to Texas. So their beef cattle herd has shrunken mightily. They were those who can afford it are trying to keep a core breeding herd and importing, as you say, the dried distiller grains. And you get these crazy patterns. On hog feed in North Carolina, the big Smithfield factory hog farms, they're importing grain from Brazil. And it's so you're getting these crazy patterns of transshipments, but it's an end of the line kind of thing. And then great outright shortages, like a year or so ago, Missouri, which is a big hay producer, Montana does too, it exports hay even, but a lot of Missouri hay went down to Texas. Now Missouri needs it for itself. It isn't there.
Right.
I think that's what we're talking about.
That's the critical thing is animal agriculture and the herds, that, you know, it'll take 3 years to rebuild a producing cow as and once you slaughter that animal and you cull the herd, essentially, it takes a long time to get that going the other way. And with the economic environment, the animal agriculture is getting very little help from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And that's why there's trouble in California, because the crop insurance has helped the feed grain producers and so forth. If they didn't have a crop and they had purchased the insurance, they can see their way through it. But there is really very little help for the dairymen, and that's really a critical part of the protein in America, the cheeses and the milks and so forth. And the Obama administration is pretty much, they just won't do anything. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because of the election coming up, who knows. But to me, it's very obvious they want to reduce the population, and this is how you do it. Mm-hmm. So I empathize with a dairyman that's really struggling right now with milk prices the same as maybe a few years ago, but the feed input is maybe double the price it was before.
Right. Yeah, and just in the last few months, it's doubled.
Right.
It's impossible. And the other thing is, if we continue on this biofuel things, because Andy, you mentioned when you put it in terms of billions, without worrying about it, I think about close to 5 billion bushels a year is going into ethanol now, which is about 40 to 50% of the crop,
mm-hmm.
of corn.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 2011, for the first time ever, this is more than what was going into livestock. And so this is a big chunk that's supposed to be taken out of somewhere. And we exported corn, not just dried distiller grains, but
mm-hmm.
to different parts of the world. So right. maybe it's to come out of there. But so I guess we should throw in here the two things about Obama, Andy, that you just said. One thing is the administration says, let's have even more biofuels. They authorize sorghum. Andy or Fred can
right.
say more about that. People are less familiar with it, although it's a very old grain.
Right.
And
is it also used for animal feed primarily?
Yes.
Yeah.
And now that's authorized for ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
And just 2 days ago, the U.S. representative, the official United States mission in Rome to the food agencies of the United Nations, we have their statement, said, we don't have to have any emergency measures internationally about any of this. The markets will take care of it. We have their
yeah.
quote. We'll put it in EIR. Right, Andy?
That's a famous solution. The markets rule, and then people die.
Right. Right.
You know, I think I'm listening to this discussion, and I couch a thought in my mind about the microbiology of the stress of these crops. The land, the soil, the microorganisms themselves are under due pressure due to the heat stress.
Uh-huh.
And this affects the long-time picture. This is why it's so important to think in the big picture about NWAPI and those projects. And even NWAPI, the project that we're interested in south in Louisiana, because maintaining the river levels on the Mississippi River, we could not get our crops out in North Louisiana because one of the grain elevators had an explosion. Another one, the drought was so bad that the river was so low that they had to come in and dredge 6 weeks during the middle of the harvest. And so we had corn under tarpaulins all over North Louisiana, the biggest football fields.
Wow.
And we still got that condition today. Well, that's okay handling corn like that, but when we get to the point of soybean harvest, we had so many acres that could not be harvested, had to wait because they couldn't get them out, and the elevators actually broke their contracts. We had them contract for $13 at the elevators, and because they couldn't get them out, they dropped the contract. Well, fortunately, the farmers would get $16 for the grain just by fluke, but they didn't have a place to go with it.
Uh-huh.
So this water management is a big issue as far as we're concerned here in the South. And the WAPI I'm really interested in it because I've been pushing the National Association of Conservation Districts. I got my state association supporting the NAWAPIC project. Took 4 years to do that. But you got to, that's why I have the one that my church has Perseverance under my name.
Uh-huh. Hey.
Okay, Fred.
But anyway, I just want to throw that thought in about, you know, there's a big story on the drying of the soils and droughts and everything, and you have to keep the soil in balance biologically. And Andy, you know more about that than I do.
Well, I think that's a critical point. Now, we have been in the Midwest, and in my particular area, I would call the drought that this is a 2-year drought thus far.
Mm-hmm.
And our,
I think the Southwest, it's several years, it's many more years, right?
Yes. Yes.
Well, that's the desert.
Right.
Right. Uh-huh.
But the University of Minnesota Farm Ag Experiment Station is nearby me here, and our soils in the top 5 feet will hold about 7 inches of moisture, and it's essentially empty right now. And they say to get back,
wow,
we have to have 12 inches of rain just to recharge.
Good grief.
The whole system. And rivers are dry. Shallow lakes are dry, and good-sized rivers. The Des Moines River is essentially, I would say, it's stopped running.
Good grief!
And the dust out on the country roads, the gravel roads. You know, you see a vehicle or a farm equipment, or the farmers working the soil out in the field or harvesting, and you can see them from miles because of the dust.
How broad an area is that affecting, Andy?
I would say the entire Midwest and,
wow,
and the West also.
Mm-hmm.
They're having fires in the state of Washington.
Right.
And all around. And northern Minnesota did have a fire at Carlstead, Minnesota, that got into the town and burnt about half a dozen houses and so forth.
Wow. Don't hear about that in the general overview of what's going on in this country.
No, it's a little bit unnerving as a farmer to see the diminished soil moisture availability, and we sort of just barely made it to the finish line this year. Our soil was exhausted, but in the areas where especially the tall grass prairie soils that were formed, they're wonderful soils. And, you know, the farmers, they would ask each other and say, where did this crop come from? How did, you know, with very little rain and high heat in the summertime, and it just had to be that the roots of those crops went down. And
uh-huh.
But Fred, now when you talk about the soil function and the microorganisms in the soil, when it gets dry like that, I think the earthworms, they just go down until they can find moisture. It's amazing how it all works, and you wonder how the earthworms can survive. And then when we get too much moisture, they're out crawling around on the top of the ground. But these things are they're really important for production. And I would say in another year we're just going to have a bigger challenge than we had this year unless we start to get more rain.
We were fortunate here in North Louisiana. We got 5 to 9 inches of rain in the last 4 or 5 days up here, and which really helped us. We got all of our corn out. Most of the soybeans are out. The cotton is still in the field, and that rain was a slow rain, so it did not knock the cotton out of the stalk, but it will affect the quality of it to a degree. But here's what happens with misinformation, and this is the lead story in today's paper, in my local paper. U.S. Department of Agriculture forecasts possible record yields for corn and rice and above average yields in other crops. Now, this is a misleading misinformation, and this is published by one of the local paper here. Well, I will challenge that later on. I won't today because I just got the paper.
Is it they're referring to like one county or something?
Well, they're talking about the northeast Louisiana is really what they're talking about.
This is for next year's production?
Yeah.
Well, that's so far off that they can say most anything.
Right.
Yeah. I just returned from a 4-state conservation meeting in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
And from Little Rock, Arkansas, north, you would see trees along the side of the road turning brown and dry and dead. This was a month and a half ago. And just there's a condition where the drought from Little Rock north is up to where you are at. It's a real serious issue and concern. So they were ready to listen to my NOAPI conversation when I got up to the soil conservation meeting.
Right. Boy, well, everyone has to be interested in that, in fact, you know, of course, because those of us who aren't farmers want to be eaters, and we do want to shift the whole, I mean, you've got a biosphere change that occurs there, not only just your immediate replenishment of agricultural potential and so forth.
That's a very important point right there you just made.
Yeah, if you look at the globe, think of the world as a whole, we have for decades, in fact, a couple centuries, but that's all right, been using, drawing down water. If you look at Eurasia, the famous Aral Sea Basin, where the Aral Sea is pretty well dried up.
Right.
And whether it was misused or not because of cotton monoculture for a while in the 30s, okay, fine. But we could have done, that's on the world agenda to do something about. Use some nuclear desalination, otherwise divert Arctic flowing water southward, a bit of it. Just like here in North America, the North American Water and Power Lines. We could have had it in operation by now. So there's equivalence on every continent, but our water tables are acutely depleted. And many, if you look, one of the most crying examples is the Transjordan, the Gaza Strip. There's really no water for people. That's obviously entirely part of the strategic great game. It's a politically imposed situation by the old British play everyone off against each other policy for over 100 years. But right now, I think it's something like 65% of the lower 48 is in some degree of drought.
Still.
As Andy was mentioning, apart from some places that fortunately got some rain, like in Louisiana, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe there will be a lot of winter snow and precip. But for this time in history, for large parts of the world to be doing a rain dance every year, that's the crazy part, isn't it?
Right, absolutely. I will never forget when you guys have been around long enough so you do remember when Lyndon LaRouche was running for president from prison in 1992. We did a series of programmatic pieces that we appeared in a local paper advertisement. They gave us a special deal. And the one on water was written by Marcia. And she led right off by saying, if you think water is just a gift of nature, you're out of your mind. Mankind creates his water resources, or he doesn't have them. And now, here we are, how many years, 20 years later, and we're really reaping the horrors of having allowed, even for a longer period than that, but even allowed this idea of the monetary system determining what you're going to be able to do for your sustenance of your population.
Yeah, the whole idea of saying it's too costly. Let's take, which is, that's the crazy part.
Right.
Life is too costly.
Costly,
and
yes.
That gets back to what Andy said about the intent of all this is depopulation if we stand by and don't do what we know how to do.
Right.
To create the conditions and grow food, produce food. But let me ask one, I get it, let me ask one question of Fred, because I know you're still active in the soil conservation districts. You're a leader there, and have been, Nancy mentioned in introducing you, for over 50 years. You're one of the seniors in the country in that, right, Fred?
Yes.
But do you want, that's a wonderful example of deliberate intervention to upgrade the landscape. It was formed under, the soil conservation districts, right, were formed in the 1930s under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Henry Wallace.
Let me give you the story, or some story on that.
Good.
In 1930s, 35, 36, 37, Roosevelt put together the Soil Conservation Service. Hugh Bennett Smith was the head of the Soil Conservation Service, who went to the Midwest and put together some of the soil conservation projects, the trees on the farms to keep the wind from blowing the soil away and everything. And of course, mm-hmm. you all know the story about the Dust Bowl.
Right.
Hugh Bennett Smith is part of the DNA on my mother's side, who was a Bennett from the Midwest.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why I say the DNA is is there on soil conservation. But I think an irony story that is really interesting, my grandfather came to Nebraska in the 1880s, started farming, built a one-room schoolhouse, and I want y'all to listen, because I went to the one-room schoolhouse last year with my two daughters, and there were two busts in the one-room schoolhouse. One bust was George Washington, and the other bust was Frederick Schiller.
Oh, wow.
No one in the community that was in there with in that room knew who Schiller was. And
but
I had
you
to
could tell
the story.
You
I
could...
said, I've got that same bust in my office, in my desk, in my house.
Wow.
And it blew them away when I told them the story. But that's culture. That's culture. But the point you're making is, yes, we can do something about the weather. I was involved 35 years ago in weather modification, putting silver iodide into the atmosphere and then creating rainfall in certain areas. I could tell you some great stories on that, Andy. You would love to hear those stories sometime.
Well, we had the same silver iodide promotion up here, and you know, I really didn't see a whole lot of benefit from that, but
the concept is there. It's just we got a lot more research to do with it.
Well, probably a much bigger longer term project than just seeding clouds or whatever is
yes.
involved in that.
Well, I agree.
So,
but you know, this soil conservation has really been a wonderful legacy for America. What it's done in, it's tailored, every region of the country has their different issues, and it's made reservoirs for certain areas, it's terraced in others so that they could farm, just like the terraces in Southeast Asia where they've got rice paddies on the side of a mountain. But you know, we have that on a maybe a bigger scale. That's wonderful infrastructure, or draining land, or restoring the land in the Southeast that the cotton monoculture had washed away a lot of the you know, the soil. And up here in the Dakotas, the project to dam the Missouri was also to irrigate, and it was called the Garrison Diversion out of the North Dakota Lake Sakakawea. And this was back in the 60s when the environmentalists then stopped this.
Oh my gosh.
It was a ditching project, and it got stopped, and they were going to run the water down the James River, and they were going to irrigate. So the compromise then was that the residents of the Dakotas would get potable drinking water for their municipalities and so forth out of the Missouri, and that has been pretty much completed, but they're still working on the very southeast part of the corner of South Dakota, and they're trying to bring it into the Iowa, Minnesota, South Dakota area. and they can't get funding from Washington, and it's called the Lewis and Clark Project, and you know it's kind of pathetic that we were going to irrigate the land, and now we're just begging to irrigate so we can, some of these communities are short on water.
Right.
And
where do they ask for money from? Is this from a special bill, or is it from the Agriculture Department, or you know?
I think it's from the Agriculture Department. They have a development part of the Agriculture Department, and it's all political.
Uh-huh.
You know, the congressman has to authorize this, and then the entire House and Senate vote for it, and
mm-hmm.
you know, to come out here and talk about a project to get water is worthy, but we could be doing so much more. What happens if the rains don't fall in the upper Missouri basin and the Missouri River is short on water? Are these people going to get any water for their municipalities? We definitely need NWAPA to start recharging and bringing this water in, and especially in times like today where we do have a cyclical dry period, and we could conceivably get into a Dust Bowl situation.
Absolutely. It sounds like we're already on the edge of it from what you said before.
In fact, Andy, you could say more about the people should know about a lot of the fires are from just working the machinery, which you have to do in the harvest in these dry conditions, could you say?
The fires were worse last year with the agriculture, the combines and so forth, but there were some around, but in the Iowa-Minnesota area, the population is larger, so the municipalities have their fire engines, as opposed to maybe in Colorado, where if you get a fire in certain areas, that there's only one town within 50 miles. So they were able to, and they got a wake-up call last year, so they were more prepared. But still, when you get a strong wind and extremely dry corn, standing corn, boy, it can be frightening.
Absolutely.
Well, this is a famous area for the very early settlers around here, that one of their biggest fears was prairie fires.
Mm-hmm.
And they would get started, and the only thing that stopped would be a good-sized lake or a river.
Right. But you say some of those lakes and rivers are actually very, very low, if not dry, right now.
Yes.
That's
It's just so obvious. I mean, maybe at a certain point when we had plenty of moisture here, that people would have thought, oh, NWAPA, we don't need NWAPA. We're fine.
Right.
But now, when there is no vision, and the Kennedy boys' men were killed and assassinated, and their projects were shut down, now 25, 30, 40 years later, we need the projects.
Right.
You know, I think what you're developing, and we've been talking about particular agriculture, but we need to talk about the overall picture of the need for the return to Glass-Steagall, because I've been working extensively on that with so many different organizations that you really can't separate the thought process of morals and economics and government and religion, and it's really one. And this Glass-Steagall is like the work with the Glass-Steagall and the WAPI and the credit system is all one.
Right.
And the important thing with this Glass-Steagall that I've had to cram down people's throats is make them think. And they don't want to think. They think of one, survival of the fittest, and what have I got and what can I do to get ahead, and I don't really care about somebody else. It's a mindset. It's a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really applaud the Schiller Institute in doing some of their classical concerts. They had one in Houston this past week. I was not able to get down there to it, but I've got a tape of it, and I'm just so pleased with that one, and when the one that the Schiller Institute did with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in
Europe.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Berlin. Uh-huh.
Right. No, you're right. It does go immediately to the credit question, and the credit question does not function without the Glass-Steagall, because we are still, contrary to every lie you've heard in the media, are bailing out these banks, you know, at a more and more. The only thing that's accelerating in this economy is the bailout of the banks, as well as the death rate and potential death rate. You know, we've got a situation now where for sections of the U.S. population, there's a lowering life expectancy. This is not supposed to be going on if you have an advancing economy. So we have to get, and there is motion on this Glass-Steagall. It's generally not oriented to the recovery perspective that you're laying out, Fred. Right yeah. Now, a lot of the people in the banking community are really the ones whom I see from our standpoint are the most active in fighting for this. For example, this former Kansas City governor of the Federal Reserve, Tom Honig.
He spoke to our National Association of Realtors here recently and gave me a breakthrough with that. You know, I tried with that group 4 or 5 years ago, and when Lynn was, we were talking about the 208, the bill that we were trying to get in place for the Glass-Steagall.
Right.
But when Tom, is it Honig?
Honig, yeah.
Honig, yeah. Honig. Thomas Honig.
Boy, he really moved it forward for me.
Great. No, and he was just in Minnesota. He was at the airport outside Minneapolis-St. Paul at a group of, bank holding companies of America meeting. They had their fall seminar just the last 2 days. And the name of his speech was The Case for Reinstating Glass-Steagall.
That's great.
He was in Washington a week or two ago speaking, and in England, speaking at, I think Washington was the Exchequer Club or so forth. But he's on a very active campaign, but the standpoint that he's taking, and I don't know that this is his only standpoint, but it's the one that's been headlined, is not been what we're talking about, which is if we don't have this, you have no production, you have no life. But it is very real, which is we are headed for a blowout of the banking system again, because everything we've done in so-called banking reform in the last 4 years has basically, you know, worsened the situation and solved nothing. So you either get this separation of commercial banks and investment banks underway now and offload the gambling debt, or you are headed for the kind of crash you've never seen before, you know, in your lifetime.
I've seen it specifically in the real estate market, where I'm helping some people try to buy some property, and I had a commitment letter from a banking institution in Oregon or somewhere for a client, and had it for 6 weeks to a month, and a week before we got ready to close, the business went belly up. And
wow.
The whole deal fell through, and the client had no alter, so he lost the contract.
Mm-hmm.
And my seller lost the sale. It's affecting real estate from a lot of standpoints. People have no idea. If you don't have earned income in the system, and I use the demonstration, I fold a piece of paper 3 times and say, this is the size of the economy today. And I said, what would happen if it was this size? And I release that paper and it comes a full sheet of paper. I said, that's 3 times more wealth to be in the economy. You could solve these problems, but you got to go back to certain policy. And then I lay out our policy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which none of our political leaders did on TV the other night, by the way.
No kidding.
What a shocker. Not one of them addressed the physical economy. Not one of them didn't even know it exists. Did they up there, Andy? I didn't see them down here do it.
Well, Bain Capital doesn't view a physical economy. They look at the parasitical economy. I don't know if they're synonymous or whatever.
You're
you know, the as you know, this election campaign is a combination of a team sport and a betting parlor, right?
Oh, my.
The way I see it, because the, unprecedented money in the campaign unprecedented, you know, red team versus blue team, and no question of the survival of the nation whatsoever, which is why LaRouche went so hard again last night, not just on the solution to the problem of the three-step solution, of the three-step program, which Fred just mentioned again, of Glass-Steagall, the credit system, and NAWAPA, but also hit the party system question. You know, we have a, and the ignorance of the population. We have a population which is now thinks in terms of choosing sides, competition, you know, beating out the other guy, surviving for an, to win the, you know, to fight another day. Isn't that one of the terms they use? You know, will you live to fight another day? Well, you know, but that's really not our purpose in living, to, even though we have to obviously fight for the solutions, but there, people are just approaching everything from the standpoint of a team sport and a battle of wills of that kind, as opposed to addressing the actual situation, the decline, the fact that we've had no profit in our economy at least since the early 1960s.
I use that scenario all the day. I use the triple curve today at breakfast. I go eat breakfast at different places, and I get a round table, and I take the triple curve and draw the picture on the table.
Wonderful.
And I have more fun. I got more new converts this morning. I got four this morning after I did the triple curve. I just have a ball with that.
Boy, oh boy. You know, someday I think we should send a photographer, Fred, to just follow you for a whole day.
I tell you what. I even used to take my lariat rope. Remember the time I brought my lariat rope to Washington, roped that congressman's chair in front of me when I...
I'll never forget it. I'll tell everyone listening right now. This was the big chamber for a full, I think it was the House Agriculture Committee, which has over 40 members, hearing. And Fred Unifeld was going to testify and said, I'll demonstrate to you. And he went down in front of the panel, and he got his lariat out, and he lassoed a chair.
Pulled it.
And you pulled it in, right?
That's right.
It didn't fight back.
But they're, all of them are living on the philosophy of survival of the fittest. I got mine. I don't care about you. They don't understand that free trade is a football game with no rules, and fair trade is a football game with rules.
Right.
And you have to keep telling them that, because we got the bread and circus mindset going on right now.
Okay. You
it's the golden calf. That's what everyone worships.
That's right.
Oh,
right.
I think the golden calf isn't going to be able to get enough feed this week. The golden calf is starving.
That's right.
This area of the Midwest, it has a history of... you know, the Follets and Charles Lindbergh Sr. And in South Dakota, it was Senator Peter Norbeck in 1933, who was the head of the Senate Banking Committee. And he, you know, that was a very, not as dire as today with the banking situation, but it was similar. And he established the investigation of the Pecora Commission. Ron Wasorek in South Dakota has this famous cartoon from the Sioux City Journal in 1933. It shows Peter Norbeck in his tie, representing him as a congressman, but then he's got his overalls on and he's got a pitchfork in his hand. And he's chasing this little guy that's Wall Street bankers, and there's someone in the, on the side of the fence and says, go after him, Peter. Get him. And we need leadership like that to, you know, that this is so outrageous. I mean, Romney, he used the Roth IRA in Bain Capital, their executives. They put money into a Roth IRA, and then that's tax-free when you take it out. Well, they rigged it so that this appreciated multiple times. And then when they took their money out, they didn't have to pay taxes on it. And then it goes offshore. I mean, this is, it's unbelievable what's going on today.
Right.
We need another Peter Norbeck and some of the others that were around from other states
Well, I can't find them because I had my congressman on the wire here the other day, and I spent 30 minutes with him. Here's a man that's on the House Agriculture, chairman, and on the Appropriations Committee, whose chairman came out and said we need to call the Congress back into session. And he says, well, there's nothing Congress can do because the president controls it with executive orders. The Supreme Court goes along with him, and the Attorney General does too, and said, our hands are tied. Can you believe a congressman would say that?
Well, and on the other side, the people on the so-called Democratic side say, well, we can't stay in office because the Republicans are controlling the Congress, and therefore, if we and the president want to do something, they won't do it. So both of them are just an exercise in total lying stupidity. And we do need, I think the pitchforks have to go with the congressmen more than before the Wall Street. With Wall Street, let's just take care of them by having Glass-Steagall, you know? Let's just throw all that debt back in their stomach and let them swallow it.
Well, I got the Glass-Steagall moving on the National Association of Realtors about 3 years ago, years ago. And of course, I keep harping it every week. I go to the chief executive there. I go to the legislative aide there. And I went to the economist. And this week, he came back with me for the first time after I sent him a whole dialogue on the evil of Paul Volcker and how he was controlled by the Rothschilds and how he controlled Jimmy Carter and ran the interest rates up and how he ran us. Andy, I don't know if you were in Washington when Volcker ran us out of Washington, the farmers, when we went up there with the agriculture movement.
Right.
Volcker ran us out of Washington. He said, you don't need to go back to the field. He wouldn't even give me a cigar either.
Oh, my gosh.
Man, I tell you.
But no civility.
But this guy is the problem. He is the problem.
His mentality is the problem. This is the monetarism, right? I mean,
oh, that's right.
It's the monetarism. He actually did come out against, for some kind of idea of a half Glass-Steagall, right? His idea was we restrict somehow the excesses of the system. He still attacks the 50 leverage of 50-1. He thinks that really is insane, which of course it is, but he will not go after the fundamental premise.
He will not.
Of monetarism. And that is what we absolutely have to do, which is why it is so refreshing to talk to farmers who have a certain sense, or people connected to farming who have a sense of the physical production on a long-term investment scale. I mean, because you're not just dealing with, okay, we turn out something, we set up a factory and we turn out something, in a couple, the next months, You're talking about an investment in the future of a long-term nature. And our population has totally been cut off from that idea. Totally cut off.
Well, I can't help but remember when I handed my white paper to Alan Greenspan and told him the mistake he made with the derivatives and off-balance sheet liabilities and the debt he's created. And I said, this is the white paper that I gave to Senator John Brough, who 2 months later resigned from Congress after he read the paper. And Greenspan looked at me and says, I made a mistake. And we've got it in our quote. He said, I made a mistake. The biggest mistake ever made. But that was his answer at the National Association of Realtors when I countered and caught him there.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I had a ball. Had a ball.
Oh, I bet.
I didn't have my laird rope, was the only thing wrong.
I think that's right. What we have to do. They got to.
So we're headed toward the end of the program here, and we really should wrap up. I want to hand it to Marcia to sort of pull us together on this whole food and programmatic situation.
Well, I had something, Andy, in just a moment I'll put to you, but I think that just the way we talked about the dairy situation being maybe one of the most acute, where you cannot If you can't afford to feed these herds, then that's the end of the line, and they have no, a minimal protection that they had called milk. I think it's milk income loss contract expired because there's no farm bill. The farm bill that was being proposed by the passed by the Senate and by the House Agriculture Committee has a lot of demerits, but we have no farm bill at all. It's as if it's part of what
it's
you all
like
just
Europe.
Talked about.
It's like Europe. They have no governments,
yes.
You know, from We're, one country to the next.
Right. So if a society is so dumbed down and so immoral and corrupt that it can't even organize to eat, obviously that's the problem. So I, without just the things that you said or that Fred said and Andy earlier in the show, we have to have this game changer intervention for Glass-Steagall. That's the basis then in which we can have credits for emergency measures in food, as well as then initiating the medium and longer term projects, which, as Linda LaRouche said on the Friday Project webcast he's doing, he did last night and he's going to do four more. You can employ millions, 14 million. That turns everything around. And there are projects everywhere, whether it's the Washita River, get that dredging and get that system going again, or the unbuilt, undone parts of the Upper Missouri system. These things are ready to go in counties all around the country. So that's, I think, what we have to push. And otherwise, I think in the final minutes, Andy, I was just going to say, to underscore everything that we've said about the physical crisis we're in, if you could return again to soil moisture and take something like wheat, because people should remember that's planted now in some of the wheat belt to the south of you, Andy, you know, in Kansas or Oklahoma or eastern Colorado, right?
Yeah.
And they don't have the soil moisture. And just describe the plantlet, what that means, whether it won't germinate or if it does germinate, what will happen next. Could you say something about that?
Well, it's really a dilemma for the wheat farmer that he has extremely dry soil, and his options are to dust it in, to plant it in the dust and hope for a rain,
uh-huh.
or to wait for a rain and then go out and plant. But uh-huh. then if you wait too long, then you're getting behind as far as the seasons go, and your prospects are diminishing. So it is a tough situation, and fortunately the wheat crop was fairly decent here in America, but that doesn't help us for next year. So we need Glass-Steagall, and we don't need to be running our cars or running our food up and down the highway.
Right. Right.
That's immediate. That could start. If that would happen, I think all this green stuff that Obama is pushing would be, it would be a really good debate.
Right. Let me just take it to the end here. I want to thank you guys for both being on. It's been delightful talking to you. But I want to bring it back to what to our audience and what we really have to be doing over the immediate period. I mean, we need, talk about a game changer, we need to change the mentality of the American population, which means we have to be challenging the stupidity that we meet every day, you know, and on high levels, like the congressman, on low levels, like our neighbors, but not who may be very good people, but they are not in political power. So the kinds of things that Fred is doing with the triple curve, that, you know, Andy, I'm sure, is doing with confronting people about the immorality of their approach to what needs to be done and what is going on in this insane election campaign. We're out to change the agenda. Everyone listening should get on the LaRouche PAC website, watch LaRouche's webcast from last night. It will tell you how to shift that agenda in a polemical, optimistic way. Yes, everything he says is very scary. It's a scary prospect out there. But you face that and you can do something about it, because we do have the solutions, and they are right in front of us. They're on the website. They're in the EIR. You can call 800-278-3135 for a new special report we're putting out on the Benghazi Gate, Obama's War on America, 9/11 Take 2. You can call and get their special reports and information on our program. 800-278-3135. I think I've run out of time. And so thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with the LaRouche Show.